going to speak for a few minutes and give us their thoughts about what they think Labour should do. I mean, this is a very wide-ranging discussion, really. It would be nice if we could have, from our panellists and from the floor, a few positive, definite suggestions of concrete things that should be done, rather than perhaps too many either, oh, woe is me, hand-wringing at all that's gone wrong in the past, or too many abstractions. Some nice concrete things would be helpful and useful when we're looking at the future of the Labour Party. So let's kick off. Who wants to start? Alison, do you want to start?
I will start now. I always like to take the microphone stand apart when I do this. So can everyone hear me okay? Yeah, at the back? Yeah, there's like loads of people in here, so I might have to go a bit Dennis Skinner, if you'll forgive me. I do have an inner Dennis Skinner, honestly. So first of all, I want to say thank you to the Fabian Society. Throughout the past few years, you have been absolutely brilliant, and Andrew Harrop and your totally amazing team have worked like absolute Trojans. So I want to say a public thank you to Andrew and the Fabian Society. I want to also say thank you to Andrew and his team for making me, Polly, Sonia and Owen the warm-up act for the main event. No pressure, but we're hoping to like whip you up into a great frenzy for the folks that are on next. I'll try not to make any poor jokes here all week. But we're supposed to be, as Polly said, talking about the future. And I promise I won't engage in any woe is me, but I really hate to lose. Over the past few weeks, people have been saying to me, like, oh, when do you think we'll get over this loss? And I have to tell them that I'm still not over being a relatively junior organiser, having lost the East Walworth Southwark Council by-election in 2003 by 250 votes to the Liberal Democrats. So I think it will be a very, very long time before I get over the loss recently. So that's what I want to talk about the future, about 2020 and about winning in 2020, which I'm absolutely determined to do. And Polly, with your approval, hopefully, I'll leave a bit of more futurology to the commentators on the panel. Because the Labour that I want in 2020 is one that wins. It's one that wins in Scotland and in Sussex, from Kilmarnock to Kent. And forgive me if, in my desire for winning in 2020, I take a bit of inspiration from one of my favourite people, Rafa Benitez. That wasn't a joke, folks. Rafa said that if you want to win, you need two things. You need to want to win, and you need to know how to win. So the first thing I want to talk about is wanting to win. We need to ask ourselves, do we want to win? Because, friends, I think it's time we started to believe in ourselves. I'm going to say something really shocking. The Labour government from 1997 to 2010 was a great government. It changed my life. It changed my family's life, from the minimum wage to the pension credit. It did great things, and I will never be made to feel ashamed of it. I'm afraid that we build our future on the platform of the past, and I will not be told by anyone that our past was not a good one. So, unfortunately, now I look back on my stressed out childhood in the 1980s, full of fear that's about to be repeated for the next generation of young people in Wirral and all around Britain. We used to have schools that I went to with outside toilets, and now our libraries are barely open as public services creak at the seams. Mums and dads in families that I talk to are absolutely as stressed out about money as I ever remember them being in my childhood. And our country does feel like we're turning away from the world and turning in on ourselves. And there's much in the world outside that needs to be done. So by 2020, I would say, let's have some pride in ourselves. And I want to ask you to help me. Next time you hear somebody go on about Gordon Brown or Tony Blair, do me a favour and correct the record. Tell them what we built out of Tory wreckage. And if you can't tell them all about it, then send them to me in Liverpool, where they will see a confident and shining city that used to be dirty and broken. Say proudly that Labour is a force for good in our country. It will be in 2020. We aren't going anywhere. We are going to stand and fight. So, hopefully, I've convinced you that in 2020, we want to win. But how are we going to do it? Honestly, I'm not sure. I don't have all the answers, but here's two places where I think we need to start. Firstly, and this will not surprise you, economic credibility. I think everybody in this room should ask themselves why the deficit matters. I think it's because your attitude to public finances defines your strength. I want a government that's powerful, not left at the warp and weft of global finance and our creditors. We've taken it for granted that people understand this. We've taken it for granted that people know that Labour understands this. Our movement now needs to make this argument. People need to hear us say it. By 2020, we're going to have gone through a really turbulent time. Not just the European referendum in this country, but still instability in the Eurozone, to say nothing of what's happening in China. People need strong economic leadership from us, and that means going back to the rules and predictability. Now, on that, look at the success that we've had. George Osborne basically accepted Gordon Brown's innovation on rules-based economic management. The OBR and all of those developments were basically a continuation of that policy. But where he failed was that emergency budget in 2010, causing a second shock to our economy after the global financial crisis that put us back in recession. And by the way, as I sat in the House of Commons listening to him announcing in-year cuts again this week, it was all too painfully familiar. So Osborne was forced to accept the Darling Plan, and we need to relentlessly call him out on that. We can make the argument, friends, for economic credibility, and we can demonstrate that we have the ability to do it. But we need the courage of our convictions. We are the party of economic stability and the strength of that brings. And if we have causes, which we certainly do, we need competence to fight for them. It's true. If you have a purpose, you need prudence. So, to finish, the second thing that we need on how to win is to never give up. I'm afraid we already have the 2020 naysayers, as I call them, the people who are already saying this is a 10-year thing. You know, we can't fix it all overnight. It's going to take another decade. Well, to that, I say absolute rubbish. I'm not prepared to tolerate it. I beg you, please, let's not give up before we've started, and let's have some self-respect, for goodness sake. We have to stand up tall, know who we are, and get ready to fight.
Thanks very much. Sonia, great. Is this on? Can people hear me? Well, Alison, you just shattered my illusion there, because I thought all these people were here to hear us speak, which clearly you all are, of course. Great. Well, I'm obviously the resident policy wonk on the panel, and so when I heard that third question around challenges and opportunities, my ears pricked up. So I guess what I'll do is try and answer some of that, what I think the big kind of challenges and opportunities facing Labour are in the kind of global context over the next 5 to 10 years or so. And then I know we've also been set the question of Scotland, so I'll try and say something about that, although I'm not sure how well qualified I am to talk about it, not being Scottish, but seeing as we haven't got someone Scottish on the panel, I'll try and chip in with my thoughts. So definitely take Polly's advice about not engaging in too much doomsaying, but I think looking forwards, one of the things we do need to think about is why did things go so wrong in 2015? And I kind of agree with Alison. I think there's actually quite a simple explanation for why we lost in England. I think it is because we lost our economic credibility, and I think that the salient question at the forefront of people's minds when they were going to the ballot box this year was, who do you trust to run the economy? And I think if you haven't got economic credibility, it's very hard to be the answer to that question. And I think, in all honesty, we lost the answer to that question way back in 2010, when the Conservatives prosecuted a really effective argument that it was Labour overspending that was responsible for the financial crisis rather than the global financial crisis. And to be honest, once that argument had taken root, I think it was very, very difficult to shift. But the reason I started off with that is because I think the only way to win elections, really, and looking forward to 2020, is to think about, well, what are the questions that are going to be at the forefront of people's minds in 2020? And what can we do as a party to convince people that we're the party that's got the kind of optimistic answer to them? And there's a few areas that I'm going to try and cover very briefly. And I think for all people, what people might say about Ed Miliband's leadership, and, you know, it's obviously been a
huge period of reflection very quickly, straight after the election, quite rightly so. I think one of the things that Ed did do quite successfully was he at least started to identify the really important questions that people were definitely thinking about. It wasn't the primary thing they were thinking about going to the election in 2015, but I think they're only going to grow in salience in the run-up to 2020. So the kinds of questions that I'm talking about when I sort of identify that is, first of all, I think the intergenerational question is really key, and I think it's going to become even more salient over the next 5 years. I think people do really believe, actually, that the next generation of young people might be the first generation who are worse off than their parents. And I think that's something that all people care about, and I don't think it's just people from a particular class. I think it's something that's pretty universal. So I think we definitely need to have an answer to that question. And I think there is some sort of, I think there's partly some really big policy questions that need unpicking there, but there's also a very significant political question. So on the policy side, for example, I think there are really, really big questions about the school to work transition in this country. And I think we looked at Germany, we looked at the apprenticeship model, we thought, oh, we'll have that back, and I think that's great. I think it really has some applicability in our economy. But I think we're seeing now with the Tories, with their really ambitious target of 3 million apprenticeships, I don't think they're going to be able to deliver it. I think there's been quite lackluster demand for employers. The way that we've seen apprenticeships expanded so far is through some very mixed quality apprenticeships primarily expanded through older groups. So I think we need to take a step back and ask ourselves some really difficult questions. For young people who don't go to university, in our uniquely British service sector economy, what does that school to work transition look like? And how can we design something, whether it's an apprenticeship or we call it something else, that really gives young people the transferable skills that they need for that labour market? I also think there are some tough political questions there around housing. So I think we all know what to do, actually, to increase affordability of housing. We all know we've got to build more houses. We've got these really ambitious house building targets, but the problem is I don't think we've got the political appetite to get us there. And that's because, actually, when you really start to unpick it, the housing market is a very zero-sum market. Everyone wants young people to be able to get onto the housing ladder, but maybe people aren't quite so sure about it when they realise that it means steadying or perhaps even falling house prices for themselves. And that's something that's just quite natural and needs unpicking. And I think we need to think about what kind of political narrative and framing works to really get people behind some of the solutions that we actually need to tackle the housing crisis. I think there's going to still be a big question about average wages in the middle of the distribution. I think Ed was really right to raise that, but I think one of the problems was we didn't really come up with an authentic policy solution. And I think actually that's probably because it's a very, very difficult policy question. What do you do about stagnating wages in the lower half of the distribution? And we don't know much about that. It's got to be a solution that involves employers and having employers think in a different way about how they deploy human capital. But the truth is we know a lot about how government can push skills out there. We don't know very much about how government can deploy skills. So I think Labour's going to need to develop an answer to that over the next 5 years. Just a couple more issues as well. I think, not big questions at all, but I think how we care for older people, again, there's a real challenge there, but a real opportunity. There's way too much variation out there in the quality of care that older people get. And we've all seen some of the horror stories that have been exposed by documentaries like Panorama. And some of it is, of course, because of the terrible working conditions in the sector. The fact that we pay people who care for our older people an absolute pittance of a wage. We expect them to pay for their own travel time between appointments. And that absolutely is one of the things that means that caring for older people in our society just becomes a series of physical tasks that actually dehumanises older people rather than seeks to support them to live fulfilled and flourishing lives. But I think there's something deeper at heart there as well, which is about our society's attitudes towards ageing people, towards older people. We have a very, very declinist philosophy of ageing in this country. And I think it's partly to do with the fact that we fear getting old ourselves and we hate thinking about the start of physical decline, mental decline. But I think it does end up meaning that we end up with a society in which older people really do get treated in some shocking ways at the end of their lives. So I think we really need to think about some creative solutions around that. What does a different system of older care look like? I think it's going to grow in salience as you have more and more people with caring responsibilities for older parents, and you have more baby boomers getting older, actually, who are probably going to say, actually, this care system isn't good enough for us. And then the last issue that I just wanted to touch on briefly was increasing diversity and Britain's role in the world as well, which Alison mentioned. There was recently some really interesting research published by some academics at the University of Manchester looking at the 2011 census and predicting forwards. And in some ways, they've predicted a really optimistic picture of diversity in Britain. So they think in 20 years' time, there's going to be 50 local authorities in Britain where actually no one ethnic group is in the majority. And that's quite incredible, actually, when you take a step back and think about it. So I think we need to be celebrating that diversity because I think it's a way that Britain will make its way in the world. I think if we want to be successful as a country, we can't sort of shut down, which is where some of the political rhetoric has been going in recent years. But I think we really need to move the political debate on from this ridiculous, you know, sort of years back we had this very liberal multicultural approach to diversity where it was all about the economic benefits and we just pretended that everyone was the same, you know, apart from which country they came from. And then we sort of, you know, gone to the complete other side of the spectrum where we've got this UKIP-induced kind of, you know, populist rhetoric about the disadvantages of immigration. I think we need to be much, much smarter about it, and I think we need to be asking difficult questions about how we promote integration to make sure that we're all living harmoniously together, we're celebrating our diversity, given that Britain is in all likelihood, going to become more diverse. And I sort of suspect I'm getting towards the end of my time here, so maybe I'll leave Britain's role in the world, although I think there's some really, really interesting things to say about that. And maybe just I'll chip in with like a sort of a moment's reflection on Scotland. Obviously, I'm not Scottish, so I'm not well placed to comment on what went on there in the same way as somebody who was there for the whole campaign. But I did go up and campaign a couple of times during the election campaign. And I think the thing that really sort of struck me about it was the extent to which you had the SNP, they'd built this powerful narrative for Scotland. It was actually based very much on kind of the negativity and defining themselves against Westminster and saying, you know, all politicians down in Westminster are the same. But the other thing that really struck me while I was up there, when I was speaking to Scottish activists, was a style of campaigning that the SNP were using. And, you know, when I was up there, we didn't see any SNP activists really out on the doorstep. And apparently what was going on was it was a very much a peer-to-peer campaign, people getting really sort of, you know, excited about the narrative and telling their friends about it. And actually, kind of, I think the Labour kind of get out the vote machine, it's a phenomenal machine, but it raises questions about our style of campaigning, I think, what happened in Scotland. There are obviously much, much bigger questions about the future of Scotland in the Union and the future of the Scottish Labour Party, but that was definitely one reflection that I took away from my time up there. So I think I'll leave
you.
It there.
Well, it's good to be amongst fellow saddos spending a Saturday, sunny Saturday afternoon in a windowless room talking about politics. How bleak can you get? But I am delighted to be the token man on the platform for a change, as it should be, as it should be. And I'm glad there's this call for hope and optimism and positivity, really important. A lot of us, I think, almost feel trapped at 10:01 p.m., back on May the 7th. That shock, that disbelief, that fear. We need to snap out of that and we need to be positive and hopeful. If we have any chance of having an inspiring, coherent alternative, then the starting point is being hopeful, is being positive, and is being optimistic. Now, I'm glad we've heard about defending the record, and I just wanted to chip in there quickly because I'm glad that point about defending the record's been made. And it sounds odd coming from someone like myself. I would caveat it. I don't think telling people about the benefits of the Iraq war is going to have the SNP voters, otherwise flooding back to us in droves. But this is what has frustrated me. Yes, I was very critical of Blair and Brown in government. So why on earth was it left to people like me to defend New Labour's own spending record, often against some of its own people? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. That what was allowed to happen is a myth that Labour spending on schools and hospitals and teachers and nurses was the cause of this mess that we are currently in. Why weren't we saying from day one that the Conservatives backed Labour spending plans pound for pound until the end of 2008 itself? That they wanted less regulation of the banks, which of course was at fault in the first place for that financial crisis. Let's defend our record. But I have to say, at the moment, there's not much defending of that record coming from many of the candidates. And again, it is left to arch critics of Blair and Brown to defend that record. And already now, the Tories and others, you see it all over the place, saying even Labour's own leadership candidates are now admitting they spent too much money. So how can we trust them again? Self-defeating. So let's have more defence of that record, absolutely. Now, we need to remember what Labour's for. Its historic mission is to represent the needs and aspirations of the wealth creators, the working people who keep this country ticking. And that used to be people often who worked in mines and steelworks and factories, now more likely to be call centres and supermarkets and offices. But those people still need a voice now as much as they ever did. But we have to face up to the fact, the inalienable truth, that social democracy is crumbling everywhere, not just in this country, but all over Europe. It's crumbling in favour of the populist right, the anti-immigration right. It's crumbling in favour of new parties of the left, and it's crumbling in favour of civic nationalist movements often embracing on economic issues the policies or at least rhetoric of the left. And that is here happening here as it is happening all over the continent. And that's to do with the lots of huge economic changes. The old industrial working class has shifted in favour of a service sector working class, which is more fragmented. You don't have work communities based around workplaces. Jobs are more transient. People do lots of different jobs in the same year, if not in the same over the course of their life, which is very different from how things used to be. Now, in the case of Scotland, you're right, we don't have someone Scottish on the platform. And we should just, I have to say, I didn't know if this statistic's right, but I have heard the statistic bandied around that half our member of the Labour Party's members are based in London, that's which is right. Itself, it's not right, apparently, but it's still probably disproportionately in London. And a lot of those debates are often excessively London-focused. Now, my own family actually live in the last Scottish Labour constituency, that mini-socialist republic up in Edinburgh. But obviously, what we have to bear in mind is the Scottish Labour Party wasn't killed up there, it basically killed itself. Okay, it abandoned its traditional role as, in the eyes of millions of Scots, as the champion of progressive politics, and the SNP filled that vacuum. It took its voters for granted. Many of those Scottish Labour MPs for many years didn't even knock on a single door of many of their constituents. And it made the fatal mistake during the independence campaign of allying with the Conservatives in a campaign of fear instead of having its own separate campaign, a positive campaign, which people like Gordon Brown, to his credit, and others called for at the beginning. That was suicidal. And as one senior Scottish Labour figure said to me, a mistake of historic proportions. And we've seen what a mistake of historic proportions that has been. Now, in my view, there's no question that that Scottish Labour Party has to be replaced with an independent Labour Party, completely autonomous in Scotland, that can fight for the progressive space that it left behind and fight the SNP, based on the fact its rhetoric does not match its policies, for genuine progressive ideas. And if you look at John Curtis's findings, the only pollster who came out covered in glory, he pointed out that Scottish Labour voters who defected to the SNP thought it was, on economic issues, more likely to support redistribution and social justice. An independent Scottish Labour Party has to rectify that, but I think it means starting from scratch, because that Scottish Labour Party at the moment, given that change of historic proportions, is simply not going to bring those voters back in anywhere near the numbers that are desperately needed. Now, we need to start talking about a mass registration drive, starting now. Look, it's unacceptable that universal suffrage fought for such great cost in this country is unwinding by stealth. That the poorer you are, the less likely you are to be registered to vote, let alone to vote altogether. And I've heard people say over and over again, the thing about non-voters is they're less likely to vote by definition, so we shouldn't waste our time doing that. Well, look, people were voting in far greater numbers in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. We have to understand and begin to understand why that's not happening anymore. But from day one now, we need a mass registration drive all over the country to actually get people registered now, so that in the next few years we actually have them registered in the first place to be able to vote. We need to learn about community organising. We need to start learning from community organisers about being a bottom-up grassroots movement, not people just knocking on doors, are you voting Labour? No, okay, next door. Now we need that bottom-up community organising approach, and the debate needs to be on exactly what form that takes. The trade unions have a big role in that. Obviously, the trade unions have huge and growing obstacles to what they can do. And they themselves, despite that hostile environment, need to find ways of organising in the private sector, the service sector, in call centres and supermarkets in a way that they haven't managed to do so far. Though I know, ironically, Unite is often castigated, but is the biggest private sector trade union in the country. The GMB is also growing in the private sector. We need to learn why. But we need a strong, successful, grassroots-based trade union movement in order to ensure the success of the Labour Party as well. So that puts responsibilities on our trade unions too. We need to think about how, again, and you've made that point about how representative we are. Ed Miliband was castigated for sounding like a geek and a wonk, but look at whole of politics. It's become professionalised. What do we expect if it's taken over by wonks? Now, what I was very proud to do in the run-up to the election is to try and support people who are underrepresented in politics, people who aren't like me, in other words, working class women, for example, people who aren't white. The party has to look representative, but it also has to have people who can better speak through lived experiences about the issues that affect people on a daily basis. So we have to have urgent action to focus in the way we focus rightly on getting more women selected, one of the great triumphs of recent years. We have to focus on getting more working class people who are representative or know their community inside out to get them elected as well. And finally, what it comes down to is having a coherent alternative. Now, I think there was this sense, basically, that Labour could have tried to win the last election by being the political wing of Witch magazine. Unfortunately, that didn't work. You can't just throw random policies into the ether and have the odd speech in the middle of the day which only losers like me bother to watch and think you've ticked a box, oh, that's immigration sorted, done. That's not going to work. And what the Tories do so successfully is they have a clear, sharp message. They repeat over and over and over again until we're tearing our hair out, but it works. Oh, well, we've certainly seen how it works. We have to have a clear, sharp message, a coherent message. We've got to remember, most people don't think in terms of left or right. They think in terms of issues to be addressed in a way that's convincing, coherent, spoken a language they understand and that resonates with their experiences. That's what we have to learn to do. But we have to sort out, we have to have a clear, coherent alternative that resonates with people, that isn't made up of random policies thrown in the ether, which most people, I have to say, didn't even know any of those policies. If you ask people to come up with three policies on the doorstep, I bet you would have struggled. So we have to, it's quite an ambitious list, I'll be honest with you. And look, I'm not convinced the current electoral system is viable or tenable because of the huge political fragmentation that has taken place. And that's why we need a new, to fight for an electoral system as well, given the huge fragmentation that's taking place, which makes, I think, as well, is important for the viability of the sort of politics that people in this room believe. But despite these huge obstacles, we have to remember our movement was always based, as Tony Benn said, he died a year ago, the way you get change is the burning flame of anger at injustice and the burning flame of hope at a better world. Let's make sure we have that burning flame of anger, but let's make sure we have that hope as well as we fight for a party that actually has genuine, convincing, coherent solutions to the people that the Labour Party was set up to represent, the working people of this country.
Ewan. Before I throw it open, I just want to ask Alison, as the representative on the panel of the Labour Party, to respond to two of the things that Owen said.
Cheers.
You won't have to give your own opinion. You don't have to give the official view. You're at this wonderful interregnum where there isn't really an official view. You can actually say what you think, which is terrific. How about the independent Labour Party in Scotland? Free, that would obviously ally with Labour at Westminster, but free not to take the whip, free not to have to agree with a Labour Party that is busy having to appeal to, as you talked about, Kilmarnock and Kent. Do you think that's a viable option? That's the first question. Second question is, isn't it time Labour really did embrace electoral reform and show that it is thoroughly democratic and open and willing to share the left of centre space with others where the future may be coalitions?
Okay, there's lots of people who want to ask questions, so I'm going to do this really quickly. And these are my personal views on Scotland. We're one Labour Party. We believe in redistribution, and that means sticking together through bad and good. So one Labour Party, folks. On electoral reform, I fought for a yes vote in the AV referendum, and we lost. So I think for the time being, I've got better things to do.
Right, okay, thanks very much. Let's hear from all of you now. I'm going to take three at a time. I'll take the guy in the black jumper here. I will take Susie Stride at the back, who was a fantastic Labour candidate in Harlow and should have won and fought a brilliant campaign. And I will take a chap here with his hand up in the middle-ish.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Excellent. My name is John from Battersea CLP, and also formerly Better Together and United with Labour. It is true that one of the reasons that we lost was a failure to challenge the economic challenge from the Conservative Party. But the other one was that Labour, as the only party which operates nationally throughout the United Kingdom, was squeezed by two dual opposing and mutually dependent nationalisms, which said that the English don't have legitimacy to represent you, or that as from the Conservative English National Party, the Scots don't have the legitimacy or the interests of you. And as Jim Murphy showed, by changing clause 4 of the Scottish Labour Party to being a nationalist clause, you cannot fight nationalism with diet nationalism. That does not work. You're merely a pallid reflection of that particular movement. You can only challenge it with an alternative, positive narrative of solidarity, of the values of the Labour Party. That is the only way that you can challenge that. So given that's the case, and given the lessons from the Scottish referendum, how should we take a vision towards the European referendum and to the future of the Labour Party, which is confident in our values and prepared to rebuild a movement based on values and not merely a technocratic machine?
Thank you very much. At the back there, have you got a microphone? Yep.
Wonderful. Susie Stride, I stood to be the MP in Harlow. One of the things that we heard over the 3.5 years in Harlow was, you're all the same. And Owen's just made the point there that we need different people in politics. What I want to know is, because we can keep saying that for the next 10 years and nothing changes, the way we changed the women thing is that we had all women shortlists. Do we need to have shortlists that say you have to have worked outside the Westminster bubble for 5 years, you have to have done a normal job? But seriously, because people are disengaged from politics, they're switching off. The people that we seek to represent are not in this room, guys. They're not in this room, and they need to be in this room if we're going to win them back. And so it's that from the grassroots up, we need different people in becoming MPs, but we need different people joining the Labour Party as well. Should we hold the Fabian Conference in the East End, in a community centre, and invite people from schools and youth clubs? We've got to change it, guys. It's got to be radical if we want to win in 2020, and we can win in 2020. And the first step to winning, and this is the final thing I'm going to say, is every single one of the people in this room, we need to get to Tower Hamlets. We've got a mayoral election. We've got 5 days to win, 5 days to get 5 days to get John Biggs as the mayor there, and send a message across this country, Labour fight back, and we start now. So can I ask all of you to join us on the doorsteps there? Yeah, really important. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There was somebody in the middle here, I think. Lexi, have you got a microphone? Well, wave your hand in the air so they can see you.
Hello, John Sailing, Islington South. I think we're kind of getting things in the wrong order a little bit. We keep talking about how we want to get more normal people involved in the party. I think the party needs to become more normal in order to attract those people. How many times have I been along to a meeting where new members are there and we start talking about procedural motions and processes and all that sort of boring stuff that no one really cares about? So let's become a more inclusive party by being more normal in the first place. Get around the table, have a chat informally, and let people enjoy being members of the party rather than stressing about making sure their motion is in the right order.
Hang on to your microphone a minute. Have you got any? I absolutely agree with what you say. Have you got any ideas how to make meetings more fun?
Yeah, I mean, don't allow more people in. I mean, I went to one meeting the other week and we were told that you're not allowed to have affiliate and supporters along to the award meetings. Makes no sense. If we want people to become party members, you need to give them a taste of it first. People don't want to sign up to go along to a meeting and be told what they can and can't do.
And you should always hold them in pubs?
You can do. I think community centres and other places, perfectly legitimate places to do it.
Very good. Should we take a few more?
Let's
take a few more, because there are so many people who want to say something. Lady over there. Where?
There.
Okay. There. And gentleman here. And the man there in the tweet.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Joanna Baxter. I'm a member of the Labour Party's National Executive Committee. And I am actually Scottish and have spent most of my life in the Scottish Labour Party. And I have to say, it really, really shocks me when I hear people who identify themselves as socialists or social democrats talking about siphoning off Scotland. And I have to say that if anyone thinks that socialist utopia lies on the other side of independence, they're absolutely fooling themselves, because the Scottish government in Holyrood is one of the most centrist governments that I've seen. They are by no means socialists or social democrats. They don't identify themselves as such. They are nationalists. We are socialists. Solidarity does not stop at the border, and if we seem to think that the solution to all our problems in Scotland is siphoning off Scotland and annexing it out, we are very, very wrong. We will win back the people of Scotland when we have a vision of hope for them, when they can trust us again, when we don't have contact rates of 0.2% in constituencies and don't listen to the people of the country of Scotland. That's how we'll win them back, not by listening to nationalists and unions that have an agenda of their own to put nationalist and identity before the principles of solidarity.
Hang on a minute. I think there might have been a misunderstanding. I think that Owen should perhaps come back. I don't think he was suggesting you have a nationalist Labour Party in Scotland, simply a separate organisation.
Yeah, to be honest, slightly surprised. I wasn't supporting the SNP. I don't think it does. I mean, Andy Byrne himself, he's one of the candidates. Obviously, he's put this forward himself to have an independent. I think it's something which needs to be debated, certainly. My view, I mean, the whole point about the SNP, as I said in my initial comments, the Labour Party in Scotland needs to challenge the fact that the SNP, their rhetoric, does not match up with the substance. That's what I said. Because the substance of what they do, they're not redistributive, for example. There are no redistributive policies that they're actually offering. I said that. The point I was making was, if we look at, for example, the work of John Curtis, a pollster who actually was found to be vindicated, he said that if you look at Labour voters who defected to the SNP, they felt the SNP was better on social justice and redistribution, which isn't true. But unless those voters can be brought back and convinced to return to the fold, who feel already that under the leadership that we had for the last 5 years, that Labour was not progressive enough, then we're not going to win. Now, my fear, I have to say, I think there'll be inevitably now this rightward trajectory of the Labour leadership. I have no idea how on earth that's supposed to win back people in Scotland who are already disillusioned in the last 5 years. So my view is simply that there should be an independent, not a nationalist party, a party which is committed to a federal Britain, which is what we need in this country, a federal country, which is based on federalism and redistribution. But there has to be, surely, after what we've learned, where the Scottish Labour Party is now facing being wiped out in 2016 in the Holyrood elections, we have to think from scratch. That's all I was saying. And that means being able to position itself as a more progressive alternative to the SNP. And I don't see how it's supposed to do that under the current conditions. That's all I'm saying.
Alison, do you want to come back on that?
I do briefly, because I heard the words independent Labour Party. Yeah. And so I wanted to make it clear that I believe in one Labour Party, because let's be clear, England itself is 85% of the Union. And the Labour Party needs to listen to people right across England who have different and diverging positions. I'm from Merseyside, for goodness sake. You know, we have our own identity that we want the Labour Party to be a part of, just as much as people in Kent and Cornwall. But, you know, there is actually, despite that diversity, more that unites us than divides us. And frankly, I fought the last election on the basis of caring about the bedroom tax in Glasgow just as much as I did in London and in Taunton, for goodness sake. So let's not give up on this idea that we have more in common than we have than divides us, wherever we are in our United Kingdom.
Microphone here. There's somebody who's got the microphone this side. Wave your hand in the air so they can see you.
I've got it.
Sorry. Oh, you go next.
Okay. I'm Paul Sowers from Cambridge, where we won, I might add.
Hey.
I think there needs to be a fresh examination of the relationship between the individual and the state, because to my knowledge, no one's looked at that closely for a long time. Because without that, you can't formulate clear policies, especially social policies, which are so close to everybody's heart.
Can you pass it back this way?
Ajay Alawalia, from Leeds, living and part of the Streatham CLP. I just wanted to bring it back to the original question and sort of think from my perspective how I want the party and the movement to inspire me. And one of the ways that I see that, and through some of our discussions this morning, was the concept of career politicians and how I want people in government, and the representative point that I think Susie meant before about people who have demonstrated themselves in industry, in business, wherever it may be, and then have come into politics. And I would like maybe a little bit of discussion around that point.
Thank you very much. Sonia, do you want to come back on any one point? They both have a bit of a go. Do you want to come pick up?
Sure. I'll pick up the point that Susie and the gentleman there just made, which is really about diversity. And I mean, I couldn't agree with both of you more. I think there are things that could be done quite easily, actually, if the party was committed to it, just to reduce barriers, for example. So I think it's nuts that we've still got a selection process that's incredibly expensive to run, and even though it's better than it was kind of, you know, maybe 5 years ago, that you still have to take quite a significant time of work for. In this modern day and age, there's got to be a selection process that we can design that isn't prohibitively expensive, but there's still tests candidates' ability to build support. So I think that would be really important, and that's something that I would like to see first. I think this point around more experience in politics, I mean, I actually, kind of reflecting on it, do think that there's a real lack of wisdom in politics. And one of the reasons for that is, I mean, we obviously do have some wisdom, but I don't want to be saying that there isn't any wisdom in politics. But I think we lack some of the wisdom that we would get, actually, if people went into politics when they were older as well. And I think there is too much of a culture of, you know, politics is a career and you need to get into parliament by your early 30s, or you haven't quite made it and you might as well give up on it. Actually, I think it's incredibly valuable to, as you say, have had a career in business and industry, have worked in one of the professions, and then decide to go into parliament in your late 40s, early 50s. I mean, I think in some ways, if you look at the FTSE 100, for example, we'd think it's nuts if the whole of the FTSE 100 was run by people in their early 40s. But actually, that's kind of what we've got with the country in some ways, and you look at political leadership. So I think we should think about ways to get more experience into politics. I think you do have to ask the question, though. I think it's not just about barriers. I think it's a perception of politics and what people can achieve while they're there. So it's taking a really kind of long, hard look at the culture and what seemed to be success in politics and how you get to be successful and how you get to sort of might get to run a government department. It doesn't really seem to be that model of you can go in your 50s and then get promoted very quickly because you bring real experience that you've got from another walk of life.
Thank you. Owen?
In fact, just very quickly, very briefly on the Scotland point, it's worth noting the Conservatives used to have a separate party in Scotland, the Unionists, and I don't think anyone would have suggested that in any way undermined their commitment to the existence of one country. There's nothing controversial, in my view, about having a separate party based up in Scotland. But the other point, about how we get a more representative parliament, the reason I think this is important isn't because people from privileged backgrounds are incapable of understanding issues that affect people who are not privileged. Of course, you know, Clement Attlee was not exactly a working class hero, to say the least. But, you know, I remember interviewing Hazel Blears before the 2010 election. I said, look, there's 5 million people languishing on social housing waiting lists. Why wasn't that addressed in 13 years of a Labour government, and she said there was just no one interested in housing in government. But I suspect if you had more people who'd been stuck on a social housing waiting list, or new people in that situation, at least in their community or their family, then those issues are more likely to be addressed, just as having more women in Parliament means issues affecting women are more likely to be addressed. And for me, it's about, I think the trade unions have a big responsibility here, because they have, obviously, they represent people who work in supermarkets, call centres and offices, for example. And they also have the resources, the money and the funds. So I'd like to see that role of the unions expanded, where they can actually use their resources and experience to actually support people, because standing as a candidate is very, very expensive and very disruptive. And that obviously gives an advantage to people who have the independent means to stand. So I think there needs to be a separate fund would be a good idea, rather than maybe a shortlist, which would end up with that Four Yorkshiremen sketch from Monty Python, people competing about who's more working class than who. I'm not sure how that would work in practice. But instead, where you have maybe a fund, a national fund, which can actually, supported by the unions, which can actually get people, working class people, people who aren't white, people who are disabled, and get them elected into Parliament. Yeah. So we actually have a parliamentary party that is representative of the country it exists to represent. Yeah.
Or stand at the back, perhaps not stand at the front. Could you stand over there? A woman with a black sleeve, wave your hand, I mean you, yes. And you too. I'll take those two women, and I'll take somebody here's already got a microphone, would they? Yeah, but I'll come to you third.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, that person.
And after that,
the person two rows in front of you.
Thank you very much. I'm Deborah Kay, I'm councillor in West Hendon. I'd like to raise an issue that I think is probably as massive as the housing issue now, but I don't think it's being covered enough by our party, and it's something that Sonia raised, and that is the issue of older people. It's a massive part of our budget, but in the Labour Party, although we have got a shadow minister, Liz Kendall, for older people's issues, she's not actually shadowing anyone in the government, but... If you look at the conference agenda, there are maybe one or two sessions for older people and older people's issues. There are offices for younger people, women, etc. And there are no offices for older people, and yet many, many Labour Party members are over 55. And I know that I pushed myself into the position of being an older person's officer, but I don't think many constituencies have even tackled that or looked at it. And I think that it's such a big thing that I think that we really should spend more time and give... and it's a growing issue, and it's going to affect everyone. So I would ask that this issue is made much bigger within the party, and that we go out and appeal to older people who actually at the moment are demonised. You know, they're made to feel guilty for living as long as they do. So, and I'm a pensioner, so I know. But that's what I wanted to raise. Right, anyway, thank
great.
You.
Could you hand the microphone two rows? Yes, the woman who's got her hand up two rows in front of you. Two, three rows in front of you. Right.
Thank you. I think we should be. Shouldn't we be getting off our bottoms and getting out there now?
Okay,
and raising things. And the first thing, well, one of the first things I want to see tackled, I want TTIP brought out from the shadows. Yeah. I think a lot of people don't know about it. They've not heard of it. And they don't know what devastating effects the ISDS element might have on their future when they've voted in, possibly here, a government that actually does want to look after people and the environment. Right. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much indeed. Yes, and as for here and now, remember what Susie said about 5 days till the Tower Hamlets mayoral election. So there's plenty to be doing straight away. There was one other person who's got a microphone, then I'll come back to Alison.
I'm Dan Grief, and I'm a teacher, and I was also the candidate in the election in South Cambridgeshire.
And you'd be insane if you want to be a candidate in the general election. And I would like to do it again, but, you know, I'm insane. It's nice to have my weekends back, but I'm here, so I don't know what that says about me. What I noticed was that the hard thing about being a candidate is that you're working full-time if you're coming from an all background, like most of us. And I was teaching on the Thursday and the Friday of the general election after not sleeping all night. And I had to face my Year 9 class at 9 in the morning. Aww. And they were lovely, they were lovely, but they might not have been. And since the election, you get very little. It's almost like you didn't exist. And actually, South Cambridgeshire, we came second for the first time ever in Andrew Lansley's old seat. And you know what? I really despair that the Labour Party doesn't actually take on the seats that we think we can't win. Because you know what? We live in not just the Wirral or certain parts of London. We live in South Cambridgeshire. I live in Cambridge. We won it, thank God. But those areas, Labour supporters feel really let down. And workers do as well, because they're being left behind by a government that doesn't care about them. And a Labour Party that's there for them, but doesn't actually bother. And actually, by just trying in South Cambridgeshire, we came second. So I think we should really be fighting in those kind of seats we don't think we've got hope in. And that's how we win.
Thank you. Three things very quickly. Last person who spoke first, Dan, congratulations. It sounds like you did really well. And you're really right. Labour should fight everywhere. That's, I guess, what I was trying to say. It's like there's nobody's vote in this country I don't want. And you mentioned the Wirral. Actually, Wirral South, where I used to represent, until 1997, people thought of it as a safe Tory seat. And the one next door, Wirral West, where we beat Esther McVeigh, folks, you know, people really thought that was a safe Tory seat. So never say never. And if you want me to come and campaign in Cambridgeshire, I'm yours. Not today. So, Deborah, you mentioned about older people. I have spent the past 5 years campaigning on care, to have better care for older people in my constituency and all around. I didn't know anything about dementia or Alzheimer's or needing care and support until I knocked on my constituents' doors, and like every third person had someone in their family who this affected, and we've got an absolute crisis on our hands. So you are right to raise it, and it's bad that the government have never appointed a minister for older people. But I just want to say something about older people in the Labour Party, that I remember being in a discussion with some of my colleagues, those of us who had tiny majorities. In 2010, my majority was 531. It's not that now, but it's 4,599. But I've got to get a shred of happiness, but this colleague of mine was saying, like, it's really terrible. All my members are really old. And I was sat there thinking, yeah, but my best member, my favourite campaigner, and I've got some really great ones, is Ivy Olsen, who's 90. And she's amazing on the phones. She phones people up and talks to them about me and about Labour and our campaigns locally. And she is a trusted voice in our community. And we've got to absolutely say here that we will stop conceiving of older people in the Labour Party and our wider society as any kind of problem. They do bring, as I think Sonia said, experience to our movement, and we should value them. They are as good campaigners as every student and young person, and I will not tolerate it be said otherwise. And finally, just on diversity and this issue of diversity in Parliament, like, we need to re-energise this discussion at no time more than right now, because as far as I can see, Parliament has taken steps backwards. And especially, somebody's mentioned people with disabilities, which I just wanted to mention. There is a fund available for candidates with disabilities to stand in the general election, and it's much undersubscribed, and we need to work out as a movement why that is. And I would very much support efforts to make real a plan for the Labour Party to recruit more parliamentarians, more councillors, more assembly members who have disabilities.
Right. Thank you. We can take a few more. There's a woman there with a red sleeve, a woman here with a maroon sleeve, and a man there with specs. Yes, wave your hand, I mean you.
Yes. I'd like to pay credit to the older people who I met when I joined the Labour Party in the 70s, and I asked them how did they get involved, and they said as kids in Fulham they'd been to the Socialist Sunday School. in London, I could find for young people classes in almost anywhere, anything, but could I find for a young person a Saturday school where they might learn an alternative narrative about politics? We're failing massively to educate young people. We have people coming out of the polling station saying, we couldn't find the name of Miliband or Cameron on the ballot paper and we didn't vote. That's the level of lack of understanding that our young people have. They don't vote, but they have not had the political education. And I think as a party, we are failing the younger generation. And I think intergenerational politics would be great. We could, I'm sure, do much more to be family friendly and have places. So, I mean, one of the lovely things I took twice today, I've met people who've come with their parents. We need more events where we cater for people of every age and they can become involved.
Thank you. Hello.
My name's Rachel Bergen. I actually stood in Hitchin and Harpenden against Peter Lilly. My question is actually related to the Scottish point, that one of the things that I learned from the Scottish referendum was that actually it was really passionate, it was really engaging, turnouts were massive, and there was a real recapturing of the lost art of political persuasion. People were on soapboxes, they had town meetings, it wasn't a case of just identifying your votes or so you could get them out on election day. It was, we have a case, we want to persuade people. And I really think that in terms of our strategy for the 2020 election, we really need to look at that. Who are the Martin Luther Kings of our generation who will really preach Labour values and who can really capture the hearts and minds of our country?
Thank you very much. We have lots of those. I've now lost my track of where I was next. Who was it I said next? Oh, it was over there. Yes.
Thank you, Jonathan Hedwood. Chelsea and Fulham CLP, where I think we came within about 15,000 votes of the Tories. I think Alexandra's here today. We've heard a lot today about how Labour might win in 2020, and that's fairly inspiring, but we've heard very little about why, and the lack of a why is pretty uninspiring. When Labour has succeeded, it has had economic credibility, but it's had it as the way of sealing a deal, which was essentially about a big progressive vision, whether that was in 1945 or 1997. Just going into 2020 with economic credibility, we are essentially talking about austerity light, unless there is a big forward-moving progressive vision as a what is the lasting achievement of the 2020 to 2025 Labour government going to be, that in 20 years future we will look back and have that as one of the things that we can bank, as we can bank the welfare state, comprehensive education, equal rights, the minimum wage, and the NHS. What's the why?
Now I'm going to come back to each of you. Sonia first. I think we probably better have just a few thoughts from each of you, and then we better wind up.
Okay. Well, just to answer your points, I mean, I completely agree with you. The why is critical. But I think we've got a bit of work to... I think we all know the fundamentals of why the Labour Party exists, why we all join the Labour Party. But I think we've got a bit of work to do over the next few years in translating to, well, what does that mean in terms of the answers to some of the questions that I was talking about? Because I think if Labour can show that it can crack the high housing crisis, that it does have something to offer young people who don't go to university other than a really watered-down apprenticeship system, then we're starting to talk legacies, really important legacies, that Labour could leave. But I think part of the problem is we're not quite sure how to get there yet. So I think that's really important. Very briefly on the care point, I think one of the points actually about the intergenerational debate is that sometimes I think there's this narrative that's taken hold that the older generation have done incredibly well at the expense of the younger generation. Now, if you look at it in aggregate, there is definitely an element of truth around that. But what that masks is that actually there are deep inequalities within a generation. And I think one of the concerns about care and older people actually is that we know that care budgets are going to be massively squeezed over this parliament. The cap cost model, I mean, it's a complete fudge. It's ridiculous to be saying to people, you're not going to have to sell your house because this cap, the cap will kick in. That's not going to happen because there's less state support with care. And I think one of my concerns is we're going to get a very two-tier system of care for older people, with people who can afford to, who are pretty to pay for it, who are pretty wealthy, being able to afford something really quite good. And then a whole bunch of older people who can't afford those kinds of services being consigned to a system that's declining in quality by the state. So I think that's a really, really important point.
Thank you. Owen.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you raised, I'm glad it was raised from the audience as well about, you know, this, the, basically the poison of the conflict of generations. It's a very dangerous kind of political approach. We often have this, you know, private sector workers against public sector workers, mm-hmm. low-paid workers against unemployed people, people living here already against immigrants. And you do have this mantra of the young versus a supposedly pampered baby boomers generation. And the lives of young people are not going to be made any better by attacking older people. And we've got to get that absolutely straight. And as you say, you can't generalise about generations. You get young people who have very rich parents who go to big public schools, and you get elderly people who are freezing in their homes because they can't afford to pay their heating bills. So you can't generalise like that. And I'd like to, you know, about care budgets, the cuts to local care budgets, the fact that about a third of elderly people aren't getting the pensioner credits that they're entitled to, for example, because of means testing. We should start talking about the, you know, a national care service. We should have answers to this, not just because people who are older are more likely to vote, but because we need to challenge this idea of it's the young versus the old. The point about TTIP, I think, I'm glad you raised that point. A lot of people don't know what it is. It's quite a wonky concept for lots of people. But basically, the threat of TTIP, which has been negotiated often in secret by the EU and the United States, is it could give large corporations the same rights as nation states, the ability to sue elected governments if they introduce policies that affect, that hit their profit. So in Australia, they introduced plain cigarette packaging, and Philip Morris used a similar treaty to sue the Australian government. And the same thing's happening in Uruguay as well. It's a threat to our democracy. It's a threat to our sovereignty. And it's an opportunity to expose the Tories on this as well. Because they'll talk about sovereignty, won't they? And they veto a treaty, not because it affects national sovereignty, but because of the city. And they think the interests of the city is the interests of the nation as a whole. That's how they portray it. But when it comes to signing away British sovereignty and hard-won rights in this country to large corporations through TTIP, they are the first to do it. So let's expose the absolute duplicity of the Tories on that. And finally, finally, Jonathan, I'm glad you raised that point. Absolutely, absolutely critical. Look, if people think that the way of getting back into power is replicating what happened in the 90s, which would mean waiting for a Black Wednesday style event, which, regardless of my criticisms of Tony Blair, I'm not quite sure any candidate standing quite has the star quality he certainly had in the 1990s, if we're going to be brutally honest about it, where you had completely different different context. But actually, I don't agree with Peter Kellner a lot, but he was right when he said the policy programme in 1997 was actually more radical than what was being offered in lots of ways at this election. A minimum wage, a windfall tax on the privatised utilities, for example. I'm sure that was portrayed as anti-business or whatever at the time. There was no point going into another election trying to be a more competent version of the Tories. The Tories actually are very competent at introducing very, very bad policies that affect people. It's not going to work. We need a coherent alternative that resonates people, that is based on hope, that addresses the burning issues that affect people who are both low income and middle income, the people who form the majority of people in this society, that can attract people back from the SNP, UKIP and the Greens, for example. We've got to have that inspiring, coherent alternative. Just echoing what the Tories are doing is fatal and will not bring back the millions of people who have abandoned the Labour Party. So let's go out there and fight for a coherent alternative.
I am so glad to hear people on this platform and all of you trying to correct the misremembered past, particularly on the issue of business. Labour has never had any support from business. In 97, not one single chief executive or board member of any FTSE 100 company supported Tony Blair or Labour. It's never been there, that support. You get a reluctant acquiescence when Labour finally wins, but you don't get support from business. I also delighted to hear Alison and the others saying, remembering Labour's brilliant past, the fantastic things, which Jonathan also mentioned, the fantastic things that Labour achieved between 97 and 2010, and reclaiming that past, I'm sure, is a very important part of the future. I'll leave you with the last word, Alison.
Thank you. What a privilege, although I am reminding myself that we are, in fact, the warm-up act. So I'm going to do this really quickly so as not to delay the next session, which I've heard might be quite interesting. On one of our our friends mentioned the A word, austerity, and whether or not we want to be kind of like Tory light on the economy. No, because George Osborne's failed. George Osborne said he would, one, deal with the deficit in one parliament, failed. Number two, protect our credit rating, failed. Number three, debt should be falling, not rising, failed. Well, it sort of fell a tiny bit at the end, but basically failed, right? So we don't want to ape the Tories in any way, shape or form. That is a different thing for sticking up for economic stability. And on the vision and what we're for, well, firstly, I want to really agree with Owen passionately about the need not to divide people, whether it's young people and old people who share many of the same concerns, whether it's on immigration. Like, my family have that history, and I will not be made to feel ashamed of it in the same way as I won't make other people feel ashamed to be immigrants either. And what unites us all in this country and around the world, I think, is the need for dignity, self-respect, and care and love of other people. That's what the Labour Party is for, and challenging that sense of powerless that people have about their own lives, whether at work or in the face of getting ahead. And what that means exactly in terms of where we should be in 2020, let me be honest, I don't know right now, but I think if we keep our values to the fore, we'll get it right.
Thank you very much to the panel. Thank you to all of you for your questions. There's just one note I've been asked to give, and I have no idea what its significance is, but would these four people please go and see the Fabian staff at the registration desk? I don't know if it's for punishment or reward. Michael Offler, Doreen Osborne, John McKee, and Sally Smith. And meanwhile, get down to Tower Hamlets with Susie. Thank you very much.
Oh, okay. Okay, very great. I've got to go.
Land value tax.
No. Is it going to be the land value tax?
Oh, I thought you were going to do land value tax.
I knew you wouldn't choose me. I'll see you. Cheers.